I'm Linda Palacio, and this is A Taste of the Past, where we take you on a journey of culinary history on the Heritage Radio Network. And I forgot to mention last time, but I want to remind everybody that we now have a section on all of our shows where you can leave comments. So if you have something to add or a question or just want to tell us how much you enjoy listening to us, you can do so in the comment portion online. And today we are sponsored by Dixon's Farm Stand Meats. Dixon's Farm Stand Meats in Chelsea Market, where you can get incredible cuts of meats and know where they came from and meet the guys who cut them up and will tell you how to cook them too. So it's Dixon's Farm Stand Meats in Chelsea Market. Today we're going to talk about the history of cooking on television and I guess the phenomenal growth of food as entertainment, as somebody once build it. And my guest is Kathleen Collins. Kathleen, welcome.
Thanks, Linda. Great to be here.
Kathleen is a librarian and a pop culture journalist. And about a year ago, she wrote a book called Watching What We Eat, The Evolution of Television Cooking Shows. And I have to say that I had a particular interest in reading your book, as having been on in the early crew of getting the Food Network up and running,
right,
and one of the first producers. And it's just amazing how you chronicled everything that happened much earlier than people would imagine.
Right.
I mean, we think of you know, food on television as being, of course, Julia Child, mm-hmm, and then the Food Network. But you take us back as far as the 1940s.
Yeah, it's of course, when you immerse yourself in something, as I did in this research, you get very self-centered. And when you talk to people about the history of cooking shows and they say, oh, yeah, Julia Child, I say, oh, she wasn't the first one. Don't you know anything? You know? And we do have to go way back, not even just to the beginning of television, but cooking broadcasting on radio.
That's
cooking,
right,
instruction on radio. So
and
I go,
and here we have come.
I know.
Full circle.
I know. Right? Radio shall never die.
Yeah.
But yeah, that, so the book is about television, but of course I mention the radio stirrings, as I call them.
Well, so in what you found out, I mean, how did you go about researching this, first of all? How did you find out about early television and who was on doing cooking shows?
A combination of different kinds of popular sources, you know, old newspaper articles. I would just look for television reviews and Variety, you know, the publication, mm-hmm, Variety, all kinds of books. I just scanned everything I possibly could, all kinds of books and newspapers and magazines. And then eventually had to venture into the archives. I looked at the Julia Child papers, Dione Lucas papers at the Schlesinger Library.
For a lot of people don't realize, Dione Lucas, she was one of the early, the first person to have a regular television, or
yeah,
was she one of the first?
Yeah, she was, because actually her show began in 1947, just a year after James Beard in 1946. But
short-lived.
Yeah, very short-lived. But part of the research involved, I mean, a huge amount of my effort was in looking to see what videos I could actually find of these old shows, because when I tell people about this book, they say, oh, you must have gotten to see some really cool things, some really interesting old videos. Well, unfortunately, no, I didn't get to see many, because they just didn't survive, or they never existed. They were shot live and there was no remnant.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are some remnants, and I did get to see some, and they were really cool. They were just fascinating to watch. But
what format were they in? Had they been transferred to a modern format?
The UCLA Film and Television Archive has a pretty good selection, and they have to transfer things to digital so that, mm-hmm, people can access and watch them. So that's the format that I saw them at the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe. There was some Dione Lucas video, or they may even have been beta tapes. I don't know. So a lot of the stuff was never transferred, is lost forever. So there's very little to see, and I had to rely a lot on text and verbal memories.
Well, you did a great job. So what was your impression about first of all, how was it received? What was your impression of how cooking on television was received?
From the beginning, you mean? Yeah.
Well, I mean, radio, World War II, it was a real,
yeah.
It was radio. I mean, that was received very well. People were writing recipes down from that, you mentioned, right?
Yeah, most of these programs were broadcast during the day and were targeted towards women because they were the consumers and they were the homemakers. And during the war, they were the only ones there taking care of everything. So a lot of it was just really important information people were sharing with each other about how to make do on very little, how to work with your ration stamps, you know, things like that. And of course, sharing recipes was always a big part of it. And that kind of information sort of got transferred to television too, although it was revolving around sponsorships. And these programs would be sponsored by the appliance companies and the flour companies. So they were really much more commercial and focused on, you know, making something that was kind of attractive to homemakers to watch. But
I noticed because I have a mutual friend of ours, my former employer, Joe Langan.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get on to that about the Food Network. But he put together a loop of some of the early Dione Lucas films. And it's interesting how, talk about product placement.
I know.
She'd be cooking a pan and say, yes, and if you use this Rivalware pan, you can make a good omelet. I mean,
yeah.
It was all about the product.
It was all about it. I mean, that was the purpose of it, really. And the idea was, let's help homemakers and give them tips and give them something to watch during the day. But really, it was about selling these products. And she was great. I mean, her personality was unmatched. She just was, she had a very dry sense of humor. She was an excellent cook. And she would sort of work these product placement things into her demonstration in what I consider to be a very humorous way. Mm-hmm. You know,
she had a very dry sense of humor. She was like a drill sergeant.
Yeah, right? Yeah. She was very, very precise, and yet her whole MO was about making cooking an art. That she said, my spatula is my palette, or whatever her famous quote was, which I forget now. But it was all about making homemakers feel like they were expressing themselves through cooking, which she considered to be a fine art.
And she had a relatively long run on television.
Yeah.
How long did she stay?
With some stops and starts, it was about a decade.
Wow.
So yeah, that's very long. I mean, that's even long now.
Yeah, and put it in terms of today's shows like Friends and popular, TV sitcoms. That's a good run.
Yeah, yeah.
There wasn't a whole lot else on television.
There was, right. And her show was on during prime time, actually. It was on in the evenings, So
even more phenomenal.
Even more phenomenal, yeah.
Yeah.
There were lots of other homemaking shows on during the day, during that same time period, but hers was on during prime time.
Those, from what I have read, were more about, as you said, homemaking.
Definitely.
Showing the new thing in appliances.
Yeah.
And, that we would just got, the country had just gotten into the industrial, really heavy into the industrial revolution.
Right.
As far as how it took over homemaking.
Right. And those shows really were legion all over the country. Local stations would make these, would get their local home economist or just some lady to deliver this information and sell some products, but definitely there was something people were getting from it as well. The viewers were getting some information about homemaking tips, and they weren't all purely cooking shows, but all sorts of things related to housekeeping and child rearing.
Well, I was, it's interesting because going back to James Beard, who came before Dione Lucas, he appeared on a lot of different shows, but when he tried to have his own show, it didn't really last too long.
No.
And do you think that, and he was such, other foodies of that time flocked to him.
Mm-hmm.
He was such an inspiration and an incredible cook, and really helped codify a lot of Americana dishes.
Mm-hmm.
Was it? Do you think that his enthusiasm and his voice just didn't transfer to the medium of television, or
that is what I've heard from people mm-hmm. who knew him, and what I've read about him is that he was had an extremely charismatic personality mm-hmm. in real life, and by the time he was on television, which was 1946, he was quite well known, and he had written several cookbooks. And maybe didn't have the reputation he ended up with as the dean of American cookery, right. but he was on his way. So it seemed like an obvious choice. And NBC, somebody at NBC said, let's get Beard in here and do a TV show. And didn't really work. He just something about him on television was stiff and not the real charming James Beard that people knew. And it just didn't work. The show probably didn't end simply because he wasn't great on TV, but I don't know, sponsorship reasons.
Well, he too was all about the product and the sponsor.
Yeah. I mean, shamelessly.
Right. I mean, if it was Borden's milk product, everything was about Borden's that day.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole
right.
recipe.
And his show was called Elsie Presents James Beard in I Love to Eat.
Elsie being, for those who don't know, Elsie was Borden's mascot, if you
right,
will.
Elsie the cow.
Right.
And, you know, what a great title, I Love to Eat, buried within that commercial title.
And he did.
And he did love to eat. But the funny thing about his show is that he is more like the kind of TV cooking show host that we see today because of his personality. I mean, granted, it didn't work on TV, but he was a personality. And he wanted to share his love of food and cooking, which was not what those other shows on in the 40s and 50s were like. They mm-hmm. were dry, it was kind of medicinal and prescriptive. And he was much more passionate about food. And that just... that really didn't fly then. The other thing was that he was on 1946. Remember how many people had TVs?
That's right.
About three.
Yeah.
And the TVs that did exist in the U.S. were really out in the public sphere, like in bars. So men were watching.
They weren't going to watch.
They actually did watch his show because it was on before the Friday Night Fights.
Oh, well.
So they were a captive audience. And he said he got a bunch of fan letters from guys who liked it. But I don't know what they did with the information. They probably just thought... I mean, TV was such a novelty. Anything on the TV would have been fun to watch.
Yeah, entertainment, right. And, well, then we move up to the 60s and boomed onto our sets was Julia Child.
Yeah. And, as I say in the book, some people think that she's the first television cooking show host, and that's factually incorrect, but in many ways she was the first of what we know as television cooking shows.
Right.
Because it, you know, as you well know, it's so much about personality, and that's what Julia was. She just, her personality was huge, and yet her show was not, the concept was not created because, oh, Julia Child's such a great personality, let's make a show around her. It was really more about the content. Let's teach people how
people
to cook French food.
People really didn't know about her. She was not yet the big personality. TV made her famous.
Absolutely.
She was, as you say, it was about content. And mm-hmm. then people got to know her personality. And,
right.
You know, you say it was all about content. And what was so wonderful about her and her shows was this certain sense of irreverence towards food. She loved it. Food was magical. It was true. But, you know, just make it happen. Mm-hmm. Make it, do it your way. If mm-hmm. it doesn't work out right, turn it into something mm-hmm. else. You know, she really had a sense of, you know, like touch it, feel it, and do it, right?
Right. Very different from anyone that came before her. And so she fit in with the times in a way, because people were getting more in touch with themselves and that, and being able to turn a recipe on its head or take something that your mother taught you and do it a little bit differently was really jiving with how people were thinking.
Right. Well, we're going to see where this takes us after we take a short break, and we'll see where Julia Child led us on in TV.
There's nothing else to eat.
Hey, welcome back. This is A Taste of the Past. We're talking with Kathleen Collins about the history of cooking shows on television. And Kathleen, you had brought us, we'd gotten as far as Julia Child. In kind of in quick succession, we have so much to talk about today. Where did we go from there?
Well, a couple people that I highlight in the book are not so famous. And the one that appeared also in the 1960s, along with Julia Child, almost literally, was Joyce Chen. And she had a show called Joyce Chen Cooks. She was really the first Asian person that we saw on cooking television. And she did, not surprisingly, she taught Chinese cooking. And she actually shared the same set as Julia Child. She was probably about half the height of Julia Child, and she had to wear high heels to make the set work for her. So she was an important figure and, you know, not really remembered in the collective memory.
Well, I mean, except that she did continue to publish some wonderful books. And then she put out a line of cookware.
Yes, all kinds still, of I have lots of her stuff.
Yeah.
And her food product line is still in good business.
But it's funny because she just, as in terms of translating, once again, we talk about, you know, does what translates to TV? And
right.
She just said, I mean, look, not all books make good movies.
Right.
I mean, it just didn't work on TV.
Right. I mean, she was very charming. Another person who is hardly remembered at all is La Diva Davis.
Mm-hmm.
She was in the 70s. And she was an African-American woman in Philadelphia. She's a school teacher teaching dance, and she was discovered when she took her dance students to WHYY in Philadelphia, and some producer said, will you do a cooking show? And she said yes, and that's how it happened. And she was extremely charming, really funny, and this was in 1975. There was a recession going on, so her show was centered around how to save money. And it was on public television. You know, why that show only lasted a year, you know, there's a million factors, as you know, that go into these things.
Well, and being on public television, a big one could have been sponsorship.
Sure.
You know, you need sponsors to keep the show on the air. So.
And we shouldn't forget, I skipped right over, one of the most important figures is Galloping Gourmet.
Oh, yes, Graham Kerr.
Graham Kerr started in the United States. We saw him in 69. And his show was only on the air, you know, first run for 2 years in the United States. But look how he's remembered in the collective memory.
That's right.
So it goes to show you, it's so much about what they bring at the right time. And also his show was, thanks to his producer wife, Trina, and his own charming personality, was about entertainment.
It really was, yeah.
That was
the goal. In fact, people didn't even think that he was a serious cook.
Right. And he was criticized by other serious cooks because he was making light of their profession, but he really was a trained cook and he was very talented. And it sort of bothered him that he was seen that way, but, you know, the show was doing really well, so.
But, well, he knew how to make it work on television.
Mm-hmm.
He knew what television was all about.
Right.
And it was entertainment.
Yeah, they both did that. They had the production values down.
Well, and then in, I guess, the next big important figure probably before we got into all our celebrity chefs,
mm-hmm,
was probably the Frugal Gourmet.
Yeah. That's who my mind skips to next as well, in the next decade, in the 80s. And again, public television, but he was the one of the most popular cookbook authors, one of the best, most watched public TV cooking shows ever. And his show was really, in the middle of the 1980s, with all the glitz and excess and dining and celebrity chefs, he was a little bit of outside of that in a way, because he liked to focus on ethnic cuisines, like true ethnic cuisines of, you know, Africa and all different kinds of places that we would never be seeing on commercial television.
Right.
And, you know, he brought something new to television and also had an extremely charming personality. I mean, a lot of people didn't like him, and of course his career ended in scandal.
Unfortunately, right.
But he was really he was very good on television. He was charming and funny. He was just on all the time.
Well, that in quick succession we did see a lot of other cooking shows come and go, or demonstrations on the news programs.
Right.
It was really taking root. And that brings us, I don't want to give short shrift to anyone, but it brings us to the real big beginnings, which were close to my heart. And that is the TV Food Network.
Right.
As it was, well, TVFN, TV Food Network, as it was called in the start.
Yeah.
And you did some good research on that to find out how that got going.
Well, thankfully, I met, somebody tipped me off to Joe Langan, as you mentioned earlier, and you know, he was really the guy who came up with the idea, and he got the whole thing started. He's still in the business.
He's on to the next move, internet cooking, right?
Yeah,
internet,
exactly.
Video.
Yeah, so as you know, it started out you know, some shaky legs there. It's not at all what we see today, which is, you know, the television cooking show industrial complex, but there were lots of different sort of stops and starts along the way, and I guess they started out showing old cooking show videos.
Well, in between, there were some original programming, and then other, you know, we weren't able to fill all the hours with original programming. So we, in fact, showed some old Dione Lucas films from her shows, and Julia Child.
Mm-hmm.
Joe managed to, I guess, finagle the rights to some of those old videos, and they were cut to fit the TV form, Food Network's half-hour format with commercial breaks, and those were shown on the air as well. But it's interesting because during that time, well, after the first few years, it was 1993 when things got formulated, went on in trial periods in 93, and then really, you know, went on the air in a lot of markets in 1994. And some of us who worked there in the early days said, oh my God, we sort of felt bad. Did we create a monster because chefs were becoming these big celebrities?
Yeah, right.
But you know, the public, we didn't create them. They were who they were. And the public was ready for them.
Right.
I guess,
exactly. You know? I mean, that's like anything in the history of this genre is things happened big because they happened at the right time, and the convergence of all these different elements, and there really was a slow simmer for this thing to be on television. People were, you know, because of the ascendancy of restaurants and chefs in the 80s, people were becoming more knowledgeable and more interested in food.
And chefs were becoming celebrities in their own right. It used to be the restaurateur. You know, you'd go or you'd walk into the restaurant and the owner would greet you, and everyone knew the owner of the restaurant, and he was the big celebrity.
Right.
And the chef stayed, you know, in a la French fashion, the chef stayed behind the stove, and nobody knew the chef. That all started to change, and celebrity chefs, you know, started to emerge. They started to emerge from behind the stove and would come out into the dining room and talk to people.
Right.
So it was natural they would go on television.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think Wolfgang Puck is probably the one of the faces of the celebrity chef, one of the early ones that people knew, oh, that's who's doing the cooking and what is he up to these days, and he would set trends.
That's right.
And that was in the 80s, so there was a lot of that coming out of the woodwork, and by the time TVFN came on, you're right, they were just ready.
Right.
And then it just, you know, its celebrity chef definition has changed dramatically.
It has. And the it's interesting, so have the demographics of who was watching. As you say, a lot of the shows were geared to the homemakers and women in particular. And boy, people found out very quickly with the rise of Emerald that the you know, a large portion of the viewership were men.
And so now we see the kinds of shows that are on really try to bring in everybody. A lot of the faces that you see on the primetime shows are men, and I don't think that's an accident. There's, you know, that dream target demographic of young males is what they're going for, and I think it's successful.
Yeah, I would imagine so. But you talk about, I mean, the title of your book is, the subtitle is The Evolution of Television Cooking Shows. And you look at the evolution of the Food Network. It went from almost as they, I hate what they call it, but the dump and stir, you know, the instructional, content-driven programming, and then to the more purely entertainment type, like Iron Chef and some of those purely entertainment type varieties. Now, where do you think they're headed? No.
Well, I think that the entertainment shows are so popular, mm-hmm. so much so that they're replicated on other networks, too, other cable networks. And you see, you know, Hell's Kitchen on Fox and everything. So that's not going anywhere. But and then, of course, during the daytime, people still say, well, the daytime is dump and stir. Yeah. We see more instructional program during the day. Those are more sort of a little bit more old school.
Right.
But I think that I've heard a lot of people sort of crying out for, well, I want more instruction.
More content,
I want it
right.
to be like it used to be yeah. when I really learned something from the Food Network.
Well, we used to sort of have that mantra, you know, like they had to have some, what was the takeaway value?
Mm-hmm.
You had to walk away. You know, people love, why do they love talk radio? We hope they love talk radio. Mm-hmm. It's because, you know, you gain something. You gain
right.
a little bit of knowledge. You learn something you didn't know before.
Right.
And that was what these cooking shows, we hoped, gave
right.
them was something they didn't know before.
Right.
Learn a new technique. Learn a new ingredient. Learn a new dish.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're doing something right because the scripts is turning the other network of the Fine Living
uh-huh.
Network over to another cooking
right.
channel.
Right. Now we're going to have two whole totally devoted food and cooking channels.
Mm-hmm. So the speculation is, will one be more devoted to mm-hmm. the dump, as we call it, the dump and stir, mm-hmm. you know, the content-driven mm-hmm. instructional programs, and
right.
one be purely entertainment food?
Right.
Or are they going to mix it up together?
Right.
That we'll
right.
have to wait and see and
right.
tune in and find out.
Right.
right? But, yeah, I think people do like, they get tired of the mindless
mm-hmm.
Entertainment, I
right.
would imagine.
Well, there's so much of it. It's like it gets to be lost with all the other kind of reality TV out there and competition shows.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not what people want to go to the Food Network for necessarily.
And with television in particular, it's all what sells, what
mm-hmm.
the advertisers can sell from.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we think it's about entertainment. We think it's about instruction. It's really about selling
right.
product.
Right, of course.
Again, right back to how it was in the 40s. Nothing changed.
Right.
You know, it was like,
and we'll see what happens on the internet, because that's where you can do a lot of instruction. You can do a lot of little close-up video type
mm-hmm.
things. A lot of people are just doing their own homegrown grassroots. You can look on YouTube. You can look on different people's blogs and websites. They're doing cooking instruction.
You know, there are over 175,000 food blogs on the internet.
Amazing.
And a lot of those do have video embedded
mm-hmm.
in them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go on YouTube with the podcasts for cooking instructions,
mm-hmm.
even the short ones. I was amazed. I really was amazed how it's
right.
just grown.
Right.
It's something that's certainly not going away.
Right. It does tell you that it's not going away, and people sort of, I think people need some of everything. I think they need the instruction, and they need the fun too, the entertainment.
Oh,
I don't,
sure.
I mean, they might say they want the instruction, but they want it to be fun to look at too, and they want to have a fun personality to deliver the information.
So where do you think new media is taking? What do you think the new media is? It is the internet, or what form do you think we might expect to see?
I just don't see the television thing going anywhere. I think
mm-hmm.
it's just going to be added on, layered on the internet, whatever form that will take. If it's going to be indistinguishable from what we see on television, I don't know. I mean, that's what people are saying now in general about internet television, is that people don't care what screen they're watching it on. As long as they get it. And as long as, you know, with food and cooking, as long as maybe they're getting something useful from it. And look, like you said, we have a whole other channel coming out on cable just for cooking. So,
and not only that channel, but a lot of the cable channels and PBS still has
right.
A day where they devote, or at
mm-hmm.
least a couple of hours they devote to cooking
right.
programs only.
Even right.
some of them are buying the old programs, or as are some of the other networks, Discovery, a couple others, I forget, buying some of the older programs
mm-hmm.
that were on the Food Network
mm-hmm.
and
right.
and running those.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, in the morning news, you can't watch a morning news program
mm-hmm.
without seeing a cooking segment,
mm-hmm,
some
mm-hmm.
instructional cooking
right,
segment.
Right.
So.
And everybody in the field is involved. You know, I read a bio of a chef, and it, invariably it says, and he's working on a pilot for a cooking show. You know, you see it all the time. It's like you have to be out there. You have to be representing yourself in all these different media.
Yeah, in my other life, I do media training for people who do want to go on camera and kind of help them cook and talk at the same time. Mm. But it's a problem. I mean, there can only be so many Emeralds or so many Marios,
right.
You know.
Yeah,
and, but
it's, I'm sure
hey,
it's...
give it a shot because you don't know what's coming around the corner.
That's right. Know? That's right.
Do your own show and just put it on YouTube. Yeah. I mean...
People are. They don't need to be invited. They're doing it.
That's right. You too can be famous. Well, I just wish we could talk on and on because I could... Ooh, we could share some good stories about the early days of the Food Network. But it is just wonderful that all of this, that we've actually, in our lifetime, that we've seen this really come about. And it's just a real magical changing time. So, Kathleen, I thank you for sharing your bit of research with us and hope that we can hear more from you about something in the future.
Great. Thank you so much,
Linda. And I want to thank you for tuning in to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio. You've been listening to the Heritage Radio Network. And we've been sponsored today by Dixon's Farms. I want to thank Dixon's Farm Stand Meats. In Chelsea Market. And our program today is produced by Jack Inslee and our engineer, Nat Wiener. And please tune in again to A Taste of the Past.